Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with musician, comedian, and cultural icon, Weird Al Yankovic. For years, Weird Al was dismissed as a novelty musician, here today, gone tomorrow. But it's been 40 years, and his weird and wonderful career shows no signs of slowing down. As he says, people often think that if something is funny, it has lesser value and doesn't deserve respect. Obviously, not me. I embrace it, and I encourage the people I work with to let their freak flag fly. Al developed his freak flag pretty early on. He was always outside the norm. Even in elementary school, when everyone was playing together at recess, Al would act out some TV show in his mind. As he tells it, I must have looked like a crazy kid, off by myself doing all these characters. It didn't make me very popular. An only child, Al did not make friends easily, and had a hard time finding his crowd, a situation which was exacerbated by being 2 years younger than his classmates. But he was so smart and, well, nerdy, he skipped a few grades. Al found solace by listening to the radio, particularly Southern California DJ Dr. Demento, who brought unique, funny novelty music to the masses every Sunday night. Al already had a unique talent. He played the accordion. So he tried his hand at making his own musical parodies, and one of them, a parody of the Knack's My Sharona, called My Bologna, made it onto Dr. Demento's radio show and quickly became the number one song on the program. With wind in his sails, Al moved to Los Angeles to see if he could make it as a comedic musician, and the rest is history. After 40 years of success, he's outlasted many of the artists that he's parodied over the years. And as each new generation of 12-year-olds rediscover Weird Al, his legend grows. As he tells it, I'm kind of a novelty dinosaur at this point, but maybe society can only handle one Weird Al at a time. Al joins off camera to talk about why MTV was such a catalyst for his career, how he once gave Madonna a lesson in the music business, why parents of only children should not be given binoculars, and just how white and nerdy he really is. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Al.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm here every week.
Good.
I wanted to have you on the show because about a year ago, my daughter came up to me and she said, Dad, have you heard of this guy, Weird Al Yankovic? And I'm like, yes, since I was your age. And then it got me thinking how many artists can make the parents laugh and the kids laugh and stay relevant for that long a time.
I don't know. I've heard a lot of stories like that. Like so many kids, like, you know, every new generation sort of discovers Weird Al.
Yeah.
And I hear these stories like, you know, hey, Dad, hey, Mom, have you heard of this new guy, Weird Al? I'm like, oh, yeah, he's been around for a while. I'm not sure what it is. I mean, my longevity surprises me more than anybody else because when I started out in the early 80s, nobody wanted to sign me to a record deal because they thought, oh, this weird novelty music, you know, that doesn't have any kind of lasting impact. I mean, it's the essence of novelty. You're like here today, gone tomorrow.
Right.
And nobody wanted to sign me because they were looking for artists that were going to have a long career. And that's sort of the big irony because my career has lasted a lot longer than, you know, most serious artists.
And most artists you parody.
Exactly, yeah.
I would say you're a genre unto yourself almost at this point.
I'm kind of a novelty dinosaur at this point. It's hard to say. I mean, yeah, I think maybe society can only handle one Weird Al at a time.
You have to move on before a new Weird Al.
It's like the Highlander, you know.
No, but I wonder about that, like, because you would look at it and go, that's a great career. I wonder why there aren't more people. Like, are there people that have, for a year here, a year there, sort of seem like they were going to?
Well, you know, what I do is pretty specific. I mean, there are a lot of people that do comedy music and do it very well. I'm a huge fan of The Lonely Island and Flight of the Conchords and, you know, Tenacious D. There's a lot of people doing terrific work doing comedy music, but they all do sort of their own thing, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you're going out on this tour called Strings Attached.
Yep.
64-piece orchestra?
It's going to vary from city to city because we're not traveling with a symphony orchestra. We don't have like 14 buses on the road.
Right.
You know, so every city we go to is pretty much a different orchestra, and I'm told it's going to vary between 41 pieces and 85 pieces over the course of the tour.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be a kind of a big deal. I mean, we did two nights at the Hollywood Bowl a couple years ago, which is sort of what inspired me to put this tour together, because it was such an amazing experience to go out on stage. And, you know, we've been playing these songs for years and years, but we've never had, like, a full orchestral backup before. And like we do our Star Wars encore. We do The Saga Begins and Yoda.
Right.
And we kick that off with the theme from Star Wars, just a little, you know, something to get everybody in the mood. And usually it's my keyboard player, like, you know, da 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 da.
Right, right, right.
And the first time we did it at the Hollywood Bowl, and we hear this 85-piece orchestra playing this theme from Star Wars, I got kind of teary-eyed, because it was sort of like, you feel like you're like in the middle of the movie.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to doing a whole tour like that, where every song is going to have this amazing accompaniment.
You know, one of the songs I was listening to this morning and thinking about was Bohemian Rhapsody, which you don't do a parody of, you just play up like a polka version, right, of Bohemian Rhapsody. But it's hilarious.
That's the, you know, usually it's a polka medley or a themed medley.
Okay.
And that's the only time I ever did an entire polka of just one song. Because I thought that that song kind of deserved it, because it had so,
yes,
many different parts, and it was epic on its own.
Yeah. I would think that'd be an amazing opportunity to think about how to use an entire orchestra and go through your whole catalog.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all that works.
You don't appreciate, you know, songs like Dare to Be Stupid or White and Nerdy unless there's a full symphonic orchestra behind it.
Right. You know, it's funny. I think there's a certain humor that musicians have that no one else really understands. And I would imagine whoever gets picked to go and do this city by city, I bet it's going to be like a highlight of their career.
I'd like to think, I give permission people to be weird,
yeah,
you know, to show their humor. Because a lot of times people in music are afraid to show it because they don't want to be thought of as a joke. In the sense that, you know, people sort of look down on comedy in music sometimes because which is the same really for a lot of movies and a lot,
right,
of other things too. But like, you know, if it's funny, people think, oh, well, this is of lesser value, or this is not meant to be given any respect or anything like that. So I think some people are leery of it being associated with something that's comedic. But obviously not me. I mean, I embrace it, and I encourage, you know, the people that work with me to let their freak flag fly as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Were there any songs that you felt culturally don't hold up or that you can't play anymore?
It's kind of a loaded question. I mean, there are some songs that don't feel quite right to be,
yeah,
playing these days for a number of reasons. I don't want to give specific examples, but I mean, yeah, that entered into the discussion when we're trying to put together a set list. You know, it's hard to say what people are going to be offended by these days. I mean, I bet people, you know, are looking for things to be upset about and be outraged by. And I honestly try not to upset people, and I take everything into consideration. But at the end of the day, you don't have control over what people are going to be upset by.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your upbringing and your childhood. I grew up in Fullerton. You grew up in Linwood, not too far apart. We had the same radio DJs we listened to. We had the same stations,
right,
KLOS, KMET,
yep,
Joe Benson and Dr. Demento.
Oh, yeah.
And I listened to the Dr. Demento radio hour every Sunday, and all of my friends knew all of the songs that made us laugh. And I think you were doing the same thing at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because I think radio is... it's something that really set me free as a kid. Previous to a lot of television programming and obviously no internet, the radio was sort of my conduit to the outside world, because I loved music so much and I loved, you know, hearing different perspectives. So I was curious, you grew up as an only child. Was your room sort of your sanctuary where you kind of developed your creativity, and was radio a big part of that?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and it was a very protective childhood. I'm an only child, and my parents kept me on sort of a short leash.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got to escape through listening to the radio, like you mentioned, you know, KMET and KLOS and things like that, and got exposed to album-oriented rock. And the Dr. Demento show was sort of an oasis for me on Sunday night, because that was when I was exposed to these people like Spike Jones and Alan Sherman, Tom Lehrer, Stan Freberg, Monty Python, all these amazing things that I never heard anywhere else. And I kind of thought, well, these were my people, you know?
Right.
And some of the material was a little blue, which is why sometimes I would have to take my AM/FM alarm clock radio under the covers of me at night on Sunday nights. And
I did the same thing. I was forced, I would be put to bed, the lights would be
right
out, and I could turn the radio so low and I could still hear it.
We're like twins, you know?
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
But that was exactly that. And we'd listen to the, you know, I'd listen to the top 10, like, you know, with the radio next to my head right before I went to sleep. And, but yeah, it was, you know, obviously no internet, no YouTube back then. And if you wanted to hear anything remotely like that, anything that strange and demented, it had to come from the Dr. Demento show.
Yeah. So do you remember a time where you clocked that, oh, my parents have one life and I have my own, not secret life, but I found my own path? Like, because you said you found your people.
Yeah.
Did you mean like you didn't find them at school, but you found them sort of through radio?
Well, in a way, I guess that's true. Because I had friends in high school, but not like super close friends. But yeah, it wasn't until later on that I really was able to kind of express myself. And find the people that were like encouraged me to, you know, submit things to the radio station,
right,
and write my own material.
Well, let me back up a little bit. Why were you an only child? Did your parents have you late?
Yeah, that was part of it. Yeah, I think my mom was in her late 30s when she had me, so
okay.
Kind of got in under the wire.
Right, for back then that was pretty late.
I have to say that it wasn't like I was saying like, Mom, Dad, I'm gonna like have a career in show business.
Right.
I'm gonna like, well, the nice thing is I couldn't say I'm gonna run off to Hollywood because we already lived in LA. I mean, it was like a 20-minute right. drive to Hollywood.
Then I'd be back by dinner.
Yeah, I always was very adult-minded, you know.
Yeah.
I graduated when I was 16 years old and went to college to get a degree in architecture. I honestly thought I was going to be an architect. I decided when I was 12 years old, all right, that's what I'm going to do. And then somewhere along the way, I got discouraged thinking, well, I'm not really that good at it or that interested in it. And meanwhile, I was, taking a shift at the campus radio station as Weird Al.
Right,
And doing fun stuff and getting airplay on Dr. Demento. And I was slowly being seduced, like, hey, maybe I can actually do this crazy stuff and make it work out.
What made it seem crazy? Like, were your parents just not involved in the arts, or did they not? Like, would you have those discussions, or did they have expectations that you do something sort of solid and academic?
Well, my parents were not involved in the arts at all, but what made it crazy was, like, nobody had made a career doing, like, you know, parody music on the accordion.
It
didn't seem like the best path to stardom.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But it was just one of those kind of things where I took a little detour just for grins, just for fun, and it snowballed into a long career. I mean, it wasn't anything I really anticipated. It was maybe something I fantasized about, but I never really thought that, you know, I would have a career doing exactly what I do.
How did you meet Dr. Demento?
I was a big fan of his show, obviously, and sent him some tapes in the mail, things I recorded in my bedroom on a little cassette tape recorder. The day I actually met Dr. Demento, he was doing an after-school assembly at my high school.
Are you serious?
Which I was very excited about. Like, Dr. Demento's coming to my school. It was like a huge deal, obviously.
Yeah.
And he was having a contest at that time. His theme song was Pico and Sepulveda.
Oh, yeah, Pico and Sepulveda.
So he was, that year, he was having a contest for listeners to come up with their version of that song, which was going to be his new theme song. And I actually brought my cassette tape and gave it to him in person at the high school assembly. I figured, oh, I'll just save the postage and I'll give it to him in person. And not only did it not win, but he lost that tape. It's lost to the sands of time.
Oh, so that was gone. So what song did he first play on the radio that you gave?
Of mine?
Yeah.
It would have been a song called Belvedere Cruising.
Okay.
Which was not a good song. I wrote it when I was 15 or 16 years old, and it was basically a love song about our family car, which was a big black 1964 Plymouth Belvedere with red upholstery and push button transmission. And it was dumb. And arguably, it just wasn't very good. And Dr. Demento would tell you that himself. It was like, the song itself wasn't that great. But he just thought, when he listened to the tape, like, here's a teenage kid playing the accordion and somehow thinking he's cool. And that by itself is a novelty. So I'll give the kid a break.
Wow. So do you remember what it felt like when you heard yourself on the radio?
You know, all those movies like That Thing You Do, like it's every movie cliche, like, you know, you're doing whatever you're doing and all of a sudden the song starts playing on the radio. And for the first 3 seconds, I think, like, who turned on the tape deck? How come my song's playing? And then you realize it's actually on the radio.
Oh, so you had no idea.
No
one called you and said, listen to the radio.
No, yeah, I just you know, like, mailed it into him. And then I'm just in my room, and the song starts playing on the radio. And as soon as I realize it's on the radio, I just kind of went nuts, just like running around the house, like screaming my head off, you know.
Right.
Which I still do every single time my song plays on the radio. Because it never gets old.
Which drives your wife just crazy.
Honey!
They're playing Eat It! So do you get your parents and bring them in and do they hear it? Like, do they understand that their son is on the radio?
Yeah, I mean, and they were very happy. I don't know if they understood completely what was going on.
They were like, see, yeah, the accordion is a cool instrument.
Right, right. But my mom told me early on, she said, you know, Al, whatever happens, just stay out of Hollywood because there are evil people there.
Really?
And she wasn't wrong. But it was just kind of always funny that, you know, they were always just very worried and protective. But I don't think they were ever really worried because they knew that, you know, I was pretty grounded and I wasn't going to, like, you know, turn into something that they didn't recognize as their son.
Hey, folks, let's take a short break from the conversation so I can talk to you about this week's sponsor, Quip. If you listen to this show regularly, you know that I talk about Quip, which is my favorite electric toothbrush of all time. And now the whole family can get refreshed with Quip. The new Kids Quip has the same 2-minute timer and guiding pulses as the original version, with no childish gimmicks, so they can brush just like a grown-up. We all use Quip in my household, and the kids love it. It gets them brushing longer, it gets their teeth cleaner, and they love the taste of the toothpaste. So that's pretty good. So for kids, the new brush is the same as the original version. It's just tweaked for size-down mouths. Kids are inspired to brush better and more often with oral care that looks and feels like the products the adults in their life use. And they're proud to use Quip. You can help them develop a grown-up routine without childish gimmicks. Quip has kid-friendly features like a small brush head, watermelon anti-cavity toothpaste, and rubber grip handles in colors little ones will love. And just like the adult version, Quip has sensitive sonic vibrations for an effective clean that's gentle on your sensitive gums. Why? Because some people brush too hard, and some electric toothbrushes are too abrasive. And with Quip, the built-in 2-minute timer pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides and to help you clean your whole mouth evenly. Do you know that 90% of us don't brush for a full 2 minutes or don't clean evenly? That's true. So you can improve your habits at the same time you're helping your kids improve their habits. And they have a multi-use cover that works as a stand, mounts to mirrors, and slides over your bristles to pack and protect your Quip on the go. And for those of you tired of bathroom clutter, Quip is great because there are no wires or a clunky charger, and it runs for 3 months on a single charge. Brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, which provides a friendly reminder when it's time for a refresh and to stay committed to your oral health, because 75% of us use old, worn-out bristles that are ineffective. Now, that's just gross. So don't do that. Get Quip. Quip is one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association, and they're backed by over 25,000 dental professionals, and they have thousands of verified 5-star reviews. So I love Quip, and my family loves Quip. We travel with Quip, we brush every day with Quip, and we're the people brushing long enough with clean bristles. So you can be too. Here's what you do. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. Now back to the show.
I read that you guys lived across the street from your high school.
We did, yeah.
And that your mom would watch you through binoculars. Sorry.
This is true. This is true. Yeah, we... Yeah, the Luna High School, which had a giant outdoor field, and my mom would occasionally watch through the kitchen window with her binoculars to make sure the kids weren't playing too rough with me.
Oh, I can imagine, especially if you're younger than all the other kids.
Yeah.
It's hard to find your crowd when you're not physically developed like the others or that...
It's both. I mean, my mom was very protective, but at the same time, I was like 2 years younger than most of my classmates because I started kindergarten a year early and I skipped second grade into third. So as a result, I started high school when I was 12.
Oh my gosh.
So
crazy.
Yeah, so I wasn't even eligible for my driver's license until my senior year. And you know, developmentally, besides being a huge nerd, I was also like, you know, sort of a little kid compared to most of the other kids in my grade.
So you're basically, you're starting high school at 12, you're playing the accordion.
So hugely popular.
Your mom's in the window with binoculars. How did you survive high school?
Barely.
Did you get bullied?
Yeah, I get picked on a lot, which is to be understood.
I know. Listen, I think that it's different now in school. I think that stuff was tolerated then more than it is now.
Yeah, I mean, my daughter had a bully in elementary school, and the school is right on that.
Right.
You know, I think people, you know, schools are a lot more able to deal with it these days, or more willing to deal with it.
Did you ever present that to your parents as this is what's going on, or did you sort of just have to run your own gauntlet of high school?
Yeah, I didn't. I maybe wasn't as forthcoming as I should have been, because if I told them anything, they would overreact. Like if
right.
I told them that somebody stole my lunch money, they'd like, well, we're gonna like hang out in front of the lunch counter every single day. I'm like, no, everything's fine. You know, you know, I don't want to come off like it was an unhappy childhood, but yeah, it was absolutely socially awkward. I mean, middle school were, I'd have to say, the two worst years of my life, and I think that's true for pretty much everybody.
And you were 10 and 11.
That is true. But it was, they were not happy years.
So how did you kind of cope with it? What do you think was your coping mechanism?
It's hard to say. I mean, you know, I guess humor in a way, because, which people, you know, translated into weirdness, because I was always a little, you know, outside the norm. I mean, even in elementary school, when everybody else was playing during recess, I would be like acting out some TV show in my mind. Like, I must look like a crazy kid, because I was off by myself, like doing all these characters out on the playground by myself. And I don't think that made me very popular.
Right. So when you heard yourself on the radio, and it's that moment, did it change your plan at all, or did it put anything on fast forward, or give you, I don't know, some hope that you could do something like that with your life, or did it feel like just a one-off?
Well, it didn't make me think like, this is what I'm going to do now, you know, because I still, you know, I was realistic, and the realistic expectation is, oh, this will be a goof, and maybe this will impress some of the kids in your high school, and maybe Dr. Mendel will play something else of yours. But it didn't really occur to me that this is going to be my new career trajectory.
Right. So what happened after that, specifically with Dr. Domeno? Did he ever reach out, or?
Well, we just continued to communicate. I sent him more stuff in the mail. After a while, he invited me to come down to the show, which was a big deal. And he had a small crew of friends that would basically answer the phone lines, take requests, make funny noises during the show, especially during the Funny Five or Top Ten time. So, you know, in my late teens, I would go down to KMET and do the live show.
So when you went off to college, you went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo,
yes.
Right? And you started radio DJing. Did you ever think, well, maybe I could do this for a living? I could be a DJ.
You know, that did cross my mind because I really enjoyed being a DJ. And it was fun. And I thought, you know, the 3 hours a week that I did the Weird Al show on our campus radio station was so much more fun and gratifying than all the time I spent in the architecture labs. I learned that I didn't love architecture, and a lot of the students that were in my classes, you know, that was their whole focus in life. They lived and breathed it, and it was important to them, and form followed function, and it was a big deal to them. And it's sort of like, yeah, you know, it's a house, whatever. I didn't have the passion for it, but I loved comedy, and I loved music, and I had a great time on the radio, and I thought, well, maybe I can be a DJ. That did enter my mind, but in those first couple years after graduating, I talked to enough miserable DJs that told me about like how their lives were, and they never had a relationship that worked, and they were constantly moving. I thought, I don't know, that doesn't sound that fun to me.
How about the parents' influence on that? Like, would you talk to them about that and say, God, I'm loving this DJ thing? And
I don't think we had that many heart-to-hearts about it. You know, I obviously kept them posted on what was happening with my life. But they never gave me a hard time about not being an architect right out of college.
They didn't?
No. You know, this is the best present I ever got from them. My dad always just told me, you know, as long as you're happy, you know, which gave me license to kind of put myself out there and do what I wanted to do. Because, you know, my dad, you know, wasn't a career guy. He, you know, had a number of blue-collar jobs. He worked at a sheet metal plant. He worked at a gas station. He was a security guard. He was a street crossing guard. I mean, he did just little odd jobs and things like that. And
what was his passion?
Hard to say.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, he had a guitar which he bought for $10 at a pawn shop, I think, which he never learned how to play. He would just strum it tunelessly and sing, which was horrible and great at the same time. But I mean, you know, he was very gregarious. He would be, you know, so forthcoming and with everybody he met. I mean, I heard to this day, somebody on Twitter was saying, like, hey, I remember your dad. He used to come into where I was a checkout guy, and he'd show me your high school picture and say, hey, you ever hear a Weird Al? That's my son.
Really?
No. But so he was just, he loved people. He loved, you know, he loved telling stories. So I think I'm a little bit of my both of my parents, because my dad was that way, and my mother was very kind of shy and introverted. And I'm kind of both. I'm, you know, I'm obviously I'm, you know, wacky on stage and other times when that's appropriate. But a lot of times I get very quiet and people just wonder if there's something wrong with me. Like, no, that's kind of just just the way I am.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you about that, because I think you don't come across as this gregarious extrovert. You do come across as more of an introvert or more introspective. And it does make me wonder if having a foot in both worlds, if you ever feel totally comfortable in either one.
Yeah, it doesn't feel awkward to me, but you know, I think sometimes it doesn't fulfill people's expectations, because when they see me in the grocery store, they think, gosh, he wasn't like bouncing off the wall and juggling the broccoli. I wonder what's wrong with him. Is he okay? You
know? He's got to go to rehab. He's miserable.
Yeah.
Okay, well, on that note, how did you get the moniker Weird Al? And was that sort of the thing you did as a DJ back then? Like, you had like was the Weird Al show on your college campus, was it sort of like your version of a Dr. Demento show?
Very much so. I like to call myself sort of the surrogate Dr. Demento for the college. I think the name first got attributed to me in my freshman year in the dorms. I was doing something, I forget what exactly, and people were like, oh, yeah, that there was Weird Al. And I thought, oh, well, that's a good radio name, because everybody on my campus radio station had some kind of wacky name like Macho Mike or, you know, the Captain. And like, oh, Weird Al, that works. I'll go with that. And
so it's kind of like embracing something that could have been an insult.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and what's nice is I've heard from so many people over the years that it's meant a lot to them, because a lot of my fans are, you know, are nerdy or outsiders or don't fit in any kind of particular mold. And the fact that, you know, here was a guy that sort of embraced his weirdness, in a way, I guess that's been inspirational for him.
Yeah. So I heard a tape from San Luis Obispo of you doing "I Won't Eat Prunes Again."
Oh gosh, do not look that up. Don't search for that.
It's fantastic.
No, it is not.
It's a parody of "Won't Get Fooled Again."
It's so bad. It's so bad.
Was that one of the first attempts at parody for you, where it's taking the song and putting different lyrics?
It was certainly early. I mean, yeah. That was gosh, when would that have been? I don't know, 78 ish. But yeah, that was definitely early.
And did any sort of light bulb go off there, where it's like, oh, I have this ability to sort of hear a song and come up with a whole alternate universe for it?
Yeah, I started doing that, you know, in my teenage years, and I gave Dr. Demento some. I think I did a parody of the Barbara Streisand Neil Diamond song, "You Don't Send Me Flowers," and I made it "You Don't Take Your Showers." I mean, you know, brilliant stuff like that. So there are a few things that were just sort of like minor hits on the Dr. Demento show. And the first one that actually was a bona fide hit on the show was "My Bologna," the parody of "My Showing by the Neck." And I was in college at the time, because I recorded that in the bathroom across the hall from my campus radio station.
Okay.
Because of the nice acoustics in the bathroom.
Right.
And I remember getting the mail one day, and there was a postcard from Dr. Demento. Like, oh, what's this? And he told me that "My Bologna" had been number one on the top 10 for 2 weeks in a row. And I thought, my life is never getting any better than this.
And the crazy thing about that is that you had a number one single on his show, but you didn't have a record for it,
no,
right?
No, and you know, I remember like going on to Hollywood and banging on doors and saying, hey, I've got a hit on the Dr. Demento show. And they'd say, we don't care. That doesn't mean anything to us.
Really?
But I mean, I would seek out records like that. I mean, when Monster Mash was a hit for the third time, I would go out and buy the single. You know, I would scour Salvation Army and Goodwill and look for like old records and try to seek out that kind of stuff. I mean, because that was my niche. That was what appealed to me.
So tell me about that, because I think also a pretty early song was "Another One Rides the Bus," right? So I read that you recorded that sort of 20 minutes before you went on the air with it or something.
I mean, that recording, the only recording that exists was done actually live on the air.
It was done live
on the air. Yeah, I rehearsed it with the people that were in the studio. Like, that was the night that I met my drummer, Bermuda Schwartz. And I'll tell you, that was September 14th, 1980. Remember the date. I had written the song that weekend, and I told Dr. Menno I wanted to play it on the show. And right before we went on, I was rehearsing it, and this guy says, "Hey, I'm a drummer. You want me to bang on your accordion case?" I said, "Sure." And that wound up being my drummer for the next, 40 years. And everybody else just made funny noises and blew duck calls and made
Because there's someone singing a low harmony along with and another one rides the bus.
Yeah. So it was all very spontaneous.
And
we did it. And thankfully, Dr. Menno just happened to press the record button on the tape machine for a sound check. And that good thing he did that because that became the master tape.
You're kidding me. And did that ever make it onto a single that...
Yeah.
It did.
That was the single, and that made it onto my first album, and that's on every single collection where you hear Another One Rides the Bus. That was that one live performance.
So did Another One Rides the Bus sort of come to you naturally when you were hearing the Queen song on the radio, or did you sit down and say, I'm going to consciously try to take a popular song and change it?
Usually it's me trying to think, what can I do with a song? And I pick like the best idea that comes to mind. Another One Rides the Bus... it was probably written in like half an hour. It was written very quickly because I didn't think, oh, this is a song I'll be playing on stage for the next four decades. It was just sort of like, oh, this will be fun to play this weekend on the show. And nowadays, when I write music, I agonize over it. I spend a lot of time crafting every single word and making sure it's as good as it can be because I realize at this point, people actually care. And I might be living with these songs for a long time. But back then it was just, oh, this is a goof. Let's see if this works.
Right. Well, and both approaches are great.
Sure.
Because when it's a goof, there's an aliveness. And
exactly.
Whatever you were doing unconsciously then, and you have to do consciously now, like, because in every one of your songs, there's one line that everything's funny, but one is just, it's transcendent. And the one there is something about I haven't been this crowded since I went to see The Who.
You know, that's a dark joke, which
it's
a lot of people don't get.
Because
it was referencing a people that actually died.
11 people died when they got crushed against, because it was general seating.
Right.
In fact, that concert changed the policy for seating at concerts.
Exactly.
And that was a big story back then.
Sure.
And I think it contributed to the fact that I wasn't allowed to go to concerts.
Really?
Because my mom heard that story.
Yeah.
She's like, you were not going to a rock concert until you're 18 because people obviously go to concerts and get killed.
Yeah.
But, you know, in that case, that line happened to be, you know, it's funny because it's true and it hits us on another level.
Yeah. And a lot of my humor and songs over the years have been kind of dark. I mean, my humor, I don't use profanity. I don't do anything really overtly sexual. And it kind of falls under the umbrella of family friendly. But there's a lot of darkness in some of the lyrics.
I think so, too. And I think you take an approach to the work that it is. It's subversive because it's humor first. But then there's a message underneath. It's commentary on society. It's not just parody. I think there's some satire in there that's pretty pointed.
You know, that's sort of a byproduct. Certainly people can glean messages and commentary from my songs, but that's first and foremost, I'm just going for the grins. You know, I'm just trying to be funny amuse people. It's true that, you know, if you peel back the layers, you might be able to find a little bit of a message.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Let's take a little break from the conversation so I could tell you about this week's sponsor, DoorDash. You know, if you're like me, you sometimes don't think about eating until you're super hungry. Then it's too late to plan and cook a whole meal or to make a good choice. But with DoorDash, you don't need to get up from the couch to get a meal cooking. You can treat yourself to the meal you deserve on demand from your favorite restaurants, because restaurants come to you with DoorDash. They connect you to all your favorite restaurants in the city, and ordering is easy. You just use the DoorDash app and choose what you want to eat, and your Dasher will bring it right to you, wherever you are. Not only is that burger place you love on DoorDash already, but over 310,000 other amazing restaurants are too. DoorDash connects you with door-to-door delivery in over 3,300 cities and all 50 states across the United States and Canada. You can order from your local go-tos or choose from your favorite chains like Chipotle, Wendy's, Chick-fil-A, and the Cheesecake Factory. So don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. And right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order when you download the DoorDash app and enter the promo code CAMERA. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter the promo code CAMERA. Again, that's promo code CAMERA for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. Are you hungry? Try it out. Now, back to the show.
What I respond to in terms of my funny bone to your songs is there's this attention to rhythm and meter that makes it work so much better. You can't just change the words to something funny. It has to honor the original meter of the song, and then when it all comes together and it's that perfect transcendent line, but it also falls within the meter, it really does elevate the humor. And I wonder about that, like, do you know when it happens and when you find something great, and is a song not done until that works just perfectly?
It's got to scan. A lot of people that are doing parodies on YouTube, they think, oh, as long as I have the same number of syllables, it's fine, which is not the case, because the accents have to be exactly right, the flow's got to be exactly right. You know, I was kind of weaned on Mad Magazine, and yeah, they did it exactly right, because they didn't have music to go along with the lyrics in the magazine, so when you read it, you had to really be able to hear the song in your head. So it was very important, reading those things in Mad, to have it flow exactly like the original song. And that's something that I, learned a lot from, because whenever I do a parody, it's got to really, match the feel and the meter of the original.
Right.
But the thing with musical comedy is, it could be just like moderately funny and still get a huge laugh because it's part of a musical composition. People catch you a lot of slack if it rhymes and it works in music. I mean, if you just told that as a joke, you'd go, all right.
Right, but the fact that it's hitting you in the rhythmically, yeah, and you're kind of moving to it.
It kind of sneaks in there, yeah.
It sneaks in, yeah. So there's a story I read about you and Paul McCartney, and I've experienced this situation as a director and a photographer where when I have an idea, I have to collaborate with somebody else. So just like you do, if you have an idea and you want to use someone else's song, you want to get permission. And in my career, there's been times when I've had an idea that I thought was perfect, but I have to present it. And I would rather have either a straight-ahead yes or a straight-ahead no. But when the person I'm presenting it to says, well, what if it was this?
Right.
And then you're in that terrible place where you're having to tell them that you don't like their idea or that's not what you do, yeah, or it doesn't. So you came to Paul McCartney and you wanted to make Live and Let Die into Chicken Pot Pie.
Right, because in the early 90s, Guns N' Roses had a hit with Live and Let Die.
Right.
So it would have been topical.
Yes.
And I hesitate to bring this up. I've talked about it in many interviews, and I hate to put Paul on the list of people who said no, but as it turns out, he felt uncomfortable with me doing a parody of one of his songs called Chicken Pot Pie, because, as you know, Paul and Linda McCartney, strict vegetarians, and
right,
they didn't want to be associated with anything that was condoning the consumption of animal flesh.
Right.
So what got back to me was, like, he'd be okay if it was tofu pot pie or, like, veggie pot pie or whatever.
Right. Which I found hilarious, because here's Paul McCartney, arguably the greatest songwriter on the planet, and he doesn't understand that tofu pot pie is not nearly as funny as chicken pot pie, because
right,
chicken sounds like living.
Right.
And that must have been a funny situation.
And the big thing was the chorus of the song would have been pop, 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 pop. So that it all tied in. It was brilliant. but yeah, it was at least it was a reason. I mean, it made sense. I mean, there was a reason he wanted me to make the change. Whereas on the rare occasions when artists say no, usually there's no reason given. Just kind of like, no, I don't have a sense of humor. Leave me alone.
Right. Well, okay. So going back to that, how far along do you take a song before you decide to present it? Like, how much of Chicken Pot Pie was completed?
I don't remember. I may have had full lyrics at that point, but what I've done, in the later part of my career is just come up with a concept. Like, as soon as I have an idea, and I'm pretty good at knowing if a concept is going to work or not. And if I have an idea, I can say, okay, I want to do a parody of your song. It's going to be called this, and it's going to be about this.
Right.
Based on that, I know I can write the song. And based on that, they should be able to tell me yes or no.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the way I've been doing it for a long time now.
Has there ever been one where you're like, this is great and that you didn't get to do it?
Well, yeah, I had a couple ideas that would have been, I think, pretty good. Prince famously never let me do any parodies, and I approached him maybe half a dozen times, and he just wasn't into it. It is pretty rare. Most people have agreed to it. I always get permission to the parodies, whether legally I have to or not. And you know, I've had a pretty good track record. Most artists look at it as sort of a badge of honor to get a Weird Al parody.
Yeah, exactly. Was there a specific Prince song that you thought that's the one?
Like, oh gosh, there are several. There was a parody of 1999 where I was going to have it be like an old late night commercial, like, you can get this for $19.99, you
know? right.
So I had several ideas, most of which I thought were pretty good, but just he wasn't into it, and it's always been my policy that if the artist doesn't want me to do it, I'm going to back off.
Did you ever meet him and, like, sort of have a face-to-face?
Not really. We've been in the same room a few times. I always got the vibe that he didn't really want to have a face-to-face. So I kind of let him be.
So was that a learning curve for you when you were starting out on how you do that stuff and how you... Because I know if you talk to the wrong person, the door can shut before you even had the conversation.
At that point, I think I'd signed my record deal, so there were people in place that, you know, lawyers that could, like, make those calls and make things happen. But when I first started out, you know, again, it was just a goof on the Dr. Amano show. When I did My Bologna and when I did Another One Rides the Bus...
You weren't getting permission from Queen.
No, I was not. And thankfully, they were good sports about it. I mean, I think I didn't get any kind of publishing at all on those songs, but they didn't, like, you know, they didn't pursue any kind of legal action. They just said, "Oh, Al's just having fun," and they were great about it. But that's when I learned, like, oh, you need permission to do this kind of stuff.
Right.
So from that point going forward, I made sure that I went through the proper channels and made sure that, you know, the artist was on board.
So how does it work? Say, take Like a Surgeon, for example. I'm sure that song got a lot of play, sold a lot of records. Is it almost like you and Madonna become co-writers on that? I mean, in terms of the publishing and royalties and all of that?
Well, I'll tell you, that was a special situation because Madonna did not write Like a Virgin.
She didn't?
That was written by Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly.
Okay.
So I got permission from them. And I met Madonna in 85 when it came out, and she liked it. She was fine with it, but I didn't have to go through her. And I noticed, I don't know if this had anything to do with me, but I noticed since then, she's always taking a songwriting credit on anything she puts out, just so she has that control, I think.
Right, but I would think in some cases, you probably help the artist.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, I heard from Nirvana's camp that after I did my Nirvana parody, they sold an extra million units of Nevermind because my parody video was on MTV in heavy rotation for a few weeks,
right.
And it kind of goosed their sales. So it's really, you know, a win-win situation for them because, you know, it shows, oh, they've got a sense of humor. And also, they actually move some units.
When did you sort of realize the power of MTV? Because I think that, you know, I remember you from Another One Rides the Bus, and then I think the very next thing I remembered was Eat It.
Yeah.
And were you aware early on that the video was going to change or add a dimension to what you do?
Well, I knew that it was going to be helpful. I had no idea how much it would really jumpstart my career. I mean,
yeah.
I was aware of the power of MTV because I and a lot of my friends just watched it constantly. It was like video wallpaper. You'd get home and you just turn on MTV and it would just be on, you know? And if a video made heavy rotation, that meant it was on like 8 times a day. So people were intimately familiar with like hits on MTV. And when they decided, I think I had 2 videos on MTV before Eat It, but when Eat It came out, that was Ricky and I Love Rocky Road.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and they were ostensibly the first comedy videos ever played on MTV, but you know they didn't get a ton of support or push. But Eat It, they decided, okay, this is it. Let's put this in a heavy rotation. And it was sort of like, you know, you hear about overnight fame. It's not always a myth. I mean, like the day after that song went into heavy rotation, all of a sudden I was being recognized on the streets. Everywhere I looked, I was getting stares, which I'd never gotten before. Like, you're the MTV guy, you know? I know you.
Right.
So it was an odd feeling.
So how did your life change after Eat It came out?
Well, I mean, at that point, aside from the fact that I was suddenly a public figure, you know, I was selling records. And, you know, I didn't know if I was going to have a career beyond my second album. Like, my first album sold okay. It was sort of enough to, like, get me to record a second album.
Okay.
But you never know. I mean, I always thought, you know, novelties, ephemeral, here today, gone tomorrow. I'm lucky to have gotten this far. But after Eat It was, like, a worldwide hit, you're sort of like, okay, now that's going to, like, you know, push me along for the next couple of years, and we'll see what happens.
Hey folks, let's take a little break from the show so I can tell you about this week's sponsor, Storyworth. You know, everyone has a family member who tells the best stories, like the one about the first snow day, or the boat trip across the Atlantic, or the hilarious college prank. I have a few of those. Not only does Storyworth preserve these narratives so future generations can enjoy them, but it also brings families together every week as they get to know each other better. Storyworth was founded by a guy who wanted his dad to record his amazing stories. The family enjoyed the process so much that they launched in April of 2013 so that families around the world can share in this gift as well. Storyworth makes it easy and fun for your loved ones to share their stories with weekly emailed story prompts, questions you've never thought to ask. At the end of the year, they'll get their stories bound in a beautiful hardcover book. Here's some of the features of Storyworth. You can write stories and upload photos by email, on the web, or in the app. You can invite an unlimited number of people to receive the stories, and you can save and edit all your stories on Storyworth.com. Here's how it works. You purchase a subscription of Storyworth for someone you love, and each week, Storyworth sends them an email with a question about their life. They simply reply to this email with their story. All stories are private and only shared with family that you choose. It's a great way to connect with your family, to stay in touch, and bridge geographic distance by providing lively discussion topics. You can learn things you never knew about your relatives and your history. Storyworth's questions elicit entertaining, surprising, and sometimes moving responses. And in the end, you get a hardcover printed book up to 480 pages. It's a great gift for Mother's Day, even last minute. As a personal example, I'm using Storyworth to find out more about my father. Before I was born, he was a race car driver, and he also shot a bullet in his leg at some point. And I know he got stranded in Mexico on a race and nearly died. So I want to know more about my father, and this is a great way to do it. And eventually, I can pass that book down to my kids so they can know their grandfather better. Also, I have siblings scattered across the United States, so that's a great way for us to keep in touch and share stories about our family. Storyworth is a fantastic way to connect in meaningful ways with your relatives, your history, and your family. And here's what Storyworth's offering right now. Go to storyworth.com/offcamera and subscribe, and you'll automatically get $20 off. It's a great deal and a great way to get started with this unique company. So check out storyworth.com/offcamera and get $20 off when you subscribe. Now back to the show.
Go back for a minute to when you first came to Los Angeles, because I just remembered something you said about your mom, which when she said that just don't move to Hollywood. Tell me about when you actually did leave college and move to Los Angeles, and sort of what their reaction was.
I think they were okay with it. I think my dad wanted me to move back home. Like, well, we can fix up the garage. We can have a nice room for you in the garage. And like, oh, I think I'll be okay. But it was my first few weeks after college. You know, I was very proud. I didn't want to take any money from anybody, and I didn't really have. I think I slept in my car for like a week. Well, this is what happened. I found an apartment in West Hollywood, just right across from Tower Records, and some guy had put up an ad on a corkboard saying basically, you can be my roommate and sleep on my couch for $100 a month. Like, oh, I can afford that. So I lived with this guy for a couple months. And one day he packed up a bunch of his stuff and said, oh, I'm going to, I think, Palm Springs for the weekend. I'm like, that's odd. He brought his TV with him. And then like an hour later, I get a bang on the door, and it's the landlord saying like, hey, I don't know who you are, but the guy that lives here owes me 6 months back rent, and you've got like 90 minutes to get out of here.
Really?
So I packed up all my stuff in my car, and I lived in my car until I found another place.
You were homeless.
Well, it's unfair to say that, because I'm sure my folks would have loved for me to go home and live with them. It's not like I didn't have a place to go, but again, I was proud, and I was like, no, I can do this, I can do this. And I got to tell you, the epilogue to that story was, years later, after I'd gotten my record deal and I was touring and doing quite well, I heard the story that that same landlord tells all prospective tenants, like, I hope you're not a deadbeat like that Weird Al guy. He still owes me 6 months back rent.
Yeah, what happened? Did you ever hear from Palm Springs TV guy?
He actually came to one of my shows.
And he did?
Like nothing was wrong. Like, hey, buddy, remember me? Like, yeah.
Wow. Tell me about those early years of, because I know you got a gig opening for Missing Persons.
Right.
They were kind of a new wave punk band. And what it wasn't probably your audience, and you got booed. And like, was there a time when you were a little lost or trying to figure it out, but you had already committed to this is what you wanted to do, and it was kind of touch and go?
Yeah, I mean, you know, after the Missing Persons experience, that proved to me that I probably shouldn't headline for a while, because, you know, I didn't think I had the audience for it, and I didn't want to be in a position where the people weren't there to see me, and I just didn't like being pelted with things.
Did you get stuff thrown at you?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Absolutely. Like, yeah, that was kind of traumatic, because I thought, oh, I like Missing Persons. They're a cool new wave LA-based group, and I'm sure their audience would love to hear accordion-based song parodies. And basically, as soon as the curtain went up and they saw the accordion, I literally was pelted for 45 minutes with everything that wasn't nailed down.
God, you know, you tell that story and I think, you know, you didn't find your crowd in school. You go off to college and you kind of found your people a little bit. But then you go out on the road and you have this idea, now I've got my thing. And
yeah.
And then the cool people still, they don't accept it, or they, you know.
Yeah.
I'm curious about how that affected you. You know, because you could look at certain comedians at that time and they were cool, like John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, and there was a sense that comedy was starting to be cool at around that time. But even though you found comedy, you didn't find those people. Like, your tribe of nerdy people that ended up taking over the world in Silicon Valley and everything, hadn't organized yet.
I get. I mean, it wasn't what I was doing was not perceived as being cool.
Right.
Certainly in the first part of the 80s. I mean, obviously I had a few big hits, but you know, I think some people looked at me as being hacky, or you know, being like very lowbrow, like you know, run low below a prop comedian, you know. So yeah, it was a little bit tough to get any kind of credibility at all, and I think the sheer fact that I've, you know, had the tenacity to just hang in there for a long period of time,
yeah,
has made people maybe rethink that a bit. Like, it's like, oh, he still hasn't gone away. Like, this is not supposed to happen.
What would keep you going when that kind of thing would happen?
Well, even in the early days, you know, I was making a living, you know, because prior to that, I was working in a mailroom for minimum wage, which at the time was like $5 an hour. And as long as I was making enough to, you know, to pay for my rent and pay for my macaroni and cheese, I was like, well, this is more fun than doing that. So as long as I could make a living doing what I loved, I thought, well, like my dad said, like, if you're happy, you're a success. And I was certainly happy.
Were you self-critical back then in terms of the work you were making? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
'Cause I know a lot of artists go through periods where they are pretty self-critical and...
Yeah, I mean, you have those voices in your head, but I don't listen to them too often. I mean, I think every creative person goes through the bipolar cycles. Like, I'm a genius, I'm a fake, I'm great, I'm horrible, you know. I heard that the famous cartoonist Tex Avery, on his deathbed, was telling people, I've wasted my life, I did nothing but these stupid cartoons my whole life. And which tears my heart out, because he was like one of the greatest and most brilliant animators ever. And he just felt like, oh, I've just wasted my whole existence on this planet, when he brought so much joy and happiness and laughs to so many people. So I always keep that in mind, that like, even though I'm doing stuff that is ostensibly silly and ridiculous, you know, I've heard from so many people that have told me, like, I was really in the dumps, I was nearly suicidal, and then I listened to your song on the radio and it kind of snapped me out of it and made me feel better. And you know, that means a lot to me. That means that even though like what I'm doing is, you know, a lot of people think it's disposable or has little value, I mean, it has value to those people.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you my own personal experience. When my daughters wanted to introduce me to Weird Al Yankovic, and we're playing some songs, and they had found songs that I hadn't heard, because they were things that I didn't come across in my 40s or whatever. We were able to kind of have a moment and share something together where we're both laughing at the same thing. You know, and that is, there's a value to that. It's hard to find every day something you can sit down with,
yeah,
your kids, and whether it's a movie or a whatever it is, where you can both enjoy it.
That means a lot to me because, yeah, I've heard that, like, I brought families closer together as well because it's a multi-generational thing. I'm a big hit on a lot of family road trips, which means a lot to me. And if you go to any of my concerts, the demographic is very wide. It's everybody from, like, embryos to dead people, pretty much. It's like
the other dead people. Are your shows?
Yeah. That's not good. They get it half price. but it's like many generations coming to the show, and they're all enjoying the show, maybe on different levels and maybe laughing at different things, but everybody's having a good time, which, you know, that and again, that's not like something that's calculated, but somehow my kind of humor just translates to a lot of different people.
Yeah. If you had to look at your own body of work and pick a song that you would say, that's my magnum opus, or that's me at the height of my powers of parody and satire, like, what is the one for you that where you really were like, that's me working at the top of my powers?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think in general I've gotten better over the years. My last six albums are much better than my first six albums. This may not be entirely true, but it's something I always told myself, is like, every album that I do, I want to make it the best thing that I've ever done. Although, you know, everybody has their own favorites. I often say that, and I've noticed this, like, everybody's favorite Weird Al album is whatever album came out when they were 12 years old. But so I don't know. I think, just some of the later material, certainly some of my hits, which I still play in concert, I think that they're hits because they do kind of stand the test of time. They've somehow connected with a lot of people, and so that I'd have to include that among my best work. I'm very partial to my original songs, which are many of which are pastiches or style parodies.
Right.
But those involve a lot more work because not only am I writing the lyrics, I'm coming up with original music, which is in the style of another artist.
Right.
There's a song on the last album called Jackson Park Express, which is like a 9-minute long song, which is sort of kind of Cat Stevens-ish, but that was I was kind of happy with the way that came out. And Mission Statement on the last album, which is kind of a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young pastiche. And you know, all the hits over the years.
Yeah.
White and Nerdy, it was, you know, kind of a...
It's kind of autobiographical.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to say it's autobiographical because every time I do a song, I'm sort of taking on a character. But that song in particular drew from a lot of personal experience because, you know, I spent my whole life doing research to write that song.
Yeah, right. Brings up a question: if you've ever wanted to make a record that was not a pastiche of anybody, not a parody of anything, but your own voice. Like, did you ever have a band or ever want to be in a band? And
there was a brief period of time there. Again, like, I was maybe like 14 years old, and I, you know, I thought, oh, I'm going to write these serious introspective lyrics, and I heard some demo tapes that I did when I was a teenager, and man,
recently,
a few years ago, but I came across them and it was so embarrassing. I was like, oh my goodness, it was just like,
well, but I mean, you're a teenager.
But still, I mean. Yeah, it's true, but it's one of those kind of things where I would be so embarrassed if any of that stuff ever. it's just, you know, I you know, my niche was more, you know, doing comedy, and anytime I tried to be serious or profound, you know, talking about social issues that I thought, you know, that a 14-year-old would think is important. It was not gelling. It was not working. And I don't think people really are dying to hear, oh, let's hear the serious Al. I mean, I'm not getting a lot of letters like that.
I don't know. I think I'd like to hear the serious Al. Well, maybe one song.
Come over to my house and I'll play you something.
I would love that.
It's not the kind of thing that I'm anxious about. Because I remember, like, when I was in college and I'd hear, you know, a band would, like, have a novelty hit.
Right.
And it would get everybody's attention. And it's sort of like, oh, well, now that we've got your attention, here's our real music. And it was always like, no, don't do that.
Well, I think you mentioned something earlier that is true, which is comedy can be so hard to do and it's written off. And I wonder if there was ever a low point where you thought, oh, the ride has finally ended. Like, did you have a low period where you're like, I'm out of favor now?
That's happened maybe once or twice. I mean, I think Well, early on, like, I had my first album did so-so, second album was a big hit, right. Third album did very well, and my fourth album...
Was that Polka Party?
Polka Party, yeah. And I kind of thought, oh, a career is a bell curve. Like, it went like this, and now I'm going like this. I thought, oh, well, I think my career is petering out, and, you know, my next album might be my last album. But my next album had it was even worse, and it had Fat, and it was, like, my biggest hit ever. So that's when I kind of learned that, okay, you know... If you're lucky, your career will have peaks and valleys, and you just have to kind of like ride it out. And if you hang in there, then hopefully you'll, you know, get to keep doing what you do.
Right. But before you made that realization that a career does this and it was doing this.
Yeah.
How did you sort of cope with that?
You know, I was just kind of thinking that, you know, I better grab all the brass rings I can while I'm still on the ride. And I don't think I ever got depressed, but I was just kind of like being realistic and thinking like, oh, well, the Weird Al thing is probably on the wane, and I don't know what I'm going to do after this, but let's just see how long I can keep this up. I never had like a 5-year or 10-year plan. I mean, you know, I never really gave a lot of thought to the future. I was just kind of like riding it out and going with the flow and seeing what happened. So I didn't know what would happen at that point if like everything kind of went away. But, you know, luckily I never had to find out.
Yeah, it's incredible, the longevity of what you've been able to do and how you've been able to maintain this career as long as you've had. And it's just fascinating to talk to you.
Well, you too.
And I really appreciate you coming in. And, you know, obviously people don't know this watching, but my kids are right out there and they got to meet you today, and that was a big treat for them. So thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm excited to see what comes out of your brain next.
I can't wait.
Thanks a lot.
Hey folks, that's our show. I really enjoyed that, and I think my daughters really enjoyed that too. We had a lot of fun this week listening back to all of Weird Al's hits and obscure numbers, and it was really fun to go back through his archive. If you're the one person who hasn't heard of Weird Al, you're in for a treat. I suggest you just type Weird Al into the computer and let the giggling begin. Or better yet, go catch Al on his Strings Attached tour, where you can see his parodies elevated to the orchestral level. And if you want to experience off-camera elevated to the orchestral level, I suggest you go to offcamera.com, which is our website and portal into our giant archive of these shows that you're listening to. First off, if you're loving this podcast and you haven't subscribed yet, well, I don't know what you're waiting for. Go to the Apple Store, subscribe, and while you're there, leave us a review and a rating. That way you'll never miss another episode, and you'll help other people find the show as well. You can also find our show weekly on DirecTV's Audience Network, Channel 239. If you don't have DirecTV but you'd like to see what you're hearing, you can get our television subscription. For just $4.99 a month, you can have access to every episode we've ever made to watch on any device as many times as you'd like. We have quite an archive built up now of these iconic, creative, curious artists, and there's no better way to dive deep into off-camera than by going back through all the episodes. So check that out, and if you like what you see and you like what you're hearing, tell people about it on social media. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. Take a minute and share your love for the show. You can also send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. You can give me guest suggestions, or if you just want some advice or just need to get something off your chest, I'm here and I'm listening. Because I'm grateful and excited that every week we get to make this show and it reaches the far corners of the earth. That's pretty cool for someone who grew up like me, loving radio and loving storytelling. So thank you for tuning in each week and making this show a reality. We hope you keep tuning in for a long time. I also want to thank everyone that helps us on this show. There's Nathan Shields, Crawford Shippey, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, and Kara Johnson. Each one of these fine individuals puts their heart and soul into this show, and we couldn't do it without them. So, thank you for that. And most importantly, be sure to join me next time when I sit down with actress Sarah Goldberg.
I got this play at the Old Vic, and we were doing 6 degrees of separation. And I remember I experienced this crippling stage fright. I had to come on late in the play, which is always really tough, because you want to get on early and get over the hurdle. So I remember waiting in the wings, and there was like a Roadrunner cartoon or like a Looney Tunes thing where there was this giant red button that said emergency stop above it. It was like a joke that every night exactly where I entered, I had to look at this like emergency stop cartoon button and just beg myself not to push it and ruin the night for everyone.
If you're like me, you've fallen in love with HBO's show Barry, starring Bill Hader and Sarah Goldberg, who plays the nuanced and realistic aspiring actress Sally. For many years, Sarah spent her time doing theater, winning praise for her work on stage in London and New York. But after a particularly difficult lull between acting jobs, Sarah got tired of eating peanut butter and banana toast in her bathrobe at 3 p.m. and decided it might be time for some job security, right around the time when HBO and Bill Hader came looking for her. Well, lucky for her and lucky for us, because Sarah brings all of her talent and stage experience to creating one of the most realistic portraits of an actress ever portrayed on screen. Sarah joins me to talk about her most horrific and embarrassing audition experience, how her role in Barry sheds light on her own profession, and why you'll never see her on social media. See you next time, off camera.